Oh, I like this one. I consider it a curse to be an intelligent and independent thinker. I feel my life would be happier if I were, quote, stupid.
Oh, yeah, that's the old...
Ignorance is bliss.
Oh, yeah, that's the old... Would you rather be... I think, was this Spinoza? Might have been Spinoza. Might not have been. Well, would you rather be a happy pig or an unhappy philosopher? Right, so that's basically the question. And I'm trying to remember exactly. I got to remember this properly. I think it might have been in Candide. I can't remember. I'll just have to paraphrase it. Dostoevsky wrote about this too. It's like, well, what makes you think you'd give up your misery? You know, like people are self-conscious. And that was presented in Genesis. The development of self-consciousness is presented as a cataclysm, right? An absolute cataclysm, an event that shattered the structure of reality when people became aware of their own nakedness and mortality. And the scales fell from their eyes and woke up and discovered death and suffering, you know, and it's tainted life. And that's exactly the complaint here. It's like, the complaint is something like, I find my expanded consciousness unbearable. It's like, well, yeah, no kidding. Look at what you see around you. You know, you see limitation and suffering, and maybe you see that even more intently. Think, well, wouldn't it be better to just be as unconscious as an animal? Well, that ship sailed a long time ago. You know, and it's not like we don't regress. That's one of the things alcohol does. You know, alcohol is definitely a drug that invites the flight into unconsciousness, partly because it works as an anxiolytic. So one of the problems with being self-conscious is that you're aware that stupid things you do will hurt you. That's very annoying. It's one of the terrible things about being awake. It's like, oh God, that would be fun. Oh yes, but then I'd have to suffer for it. Oh no, that means I can't have fun. Better go get drunk. Then the fact that it might hurt me won't bother me, and I can have some fun. And that is exactly what alcohol does. And it's a negative transcendence, which is how Aldous Huxley described alcohol. And it's very tempting, and no bloody wonder. It's like people are rushing all the time to escape from the burden of their acute self-consciousness. Like, self-consciousness as a phenomenon loads on trait neuroticism. So, you know, because to say, well, I got self-conscious when I talked, it's like, well, that's an elevated form of consciousness, but it's very painful because it makes you aware of your inadequacy. Okay, there's a great book about this, by the way. It's a very hard book, but it's a great book called The Origins and History of Consciousness by a man named Eric Neumann. I was just talking to Camille Pellia yesterday. She just wrote a new book. And she wrote an essay about 20 years ago suggesting that the best thinker for English, for literary critics to have chosen as an alternative to Derrida and Foucault would have been Eric Neumann, who was a student of Jung's. And I agree with that. Origins and History of Consciousness is a brilliant book. And one of the things he points out is that there's a struggle in human beings. Consciousness has to struggle upwards, and it's pulled downwards by the desire for unconsciousness. That's part of the Oedipal catastrophe of Freud. It's like, because an overdependent mother can say, look, kiddo, going out in the world and challenging yourself and developing that self-consciousness is going to introduce you to a world of pain and agony as you become more and more aware. It's like, I can pull you back and shelter you from all that. Now, the problem is that there's a crippling that goes along with that. But Jung characterized that Oedipal relationship as a conspiracy between mother and child. It's not something the mother imposes. It's like a pathological invitation. It's like, just stay with me and you'll never have to face the catastrophes of the world. It's like, well, that's a potent invitation given the catastrophes of the world. You see this reflected as well. I wrote about this in 12 Rules, that famous statue by Michelangelo, the Pieta, right, where you see Mary holding the broken body of Christ in her arms. It's like that's the female crucifixion in some sense. It's like, because what a woman has to do with her son is offer him up to be broken by the world, and he has to take that responsibility onto himself. And so that's a dreadful thing. And so then the question is, what do you do about it? And see, this is part of what struck me so hard about Christianity as a philosophical system, and it's Judeo-Christianity more broadly speaking, and maybe even the sum total of the searching for human wisdom across all of the time that we've been self-conscious is, what's the antidote to self-consciousness? Well, one is a return to unconscious oblivion. And that's a suicidal desire. It might even be a genocidal desire. You know, it might underlie our desire to drive ourselves to the brink of nuclear destruction, saying that it would be better if being itself didn't exist because of its suffering. That's one way out. It'll obliterate everything because of its suffering. The other way out is more consciousness, more attention, more of what's poisoning you. Because that's the way out, is to become more conscious. So here, I'll give you an example. This is one of the most brilliant things I've ever seen. There's this painting that was done in the Middle Ages. It's in my book, Maps of Meaning. And it's a tree. And it's the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And the tree has on one half of it, it's all right. I'll just finish. I appreciate it, but it's okay. You were just going to show me the picture, I believe. But I'll just go on with it. So, all right. So on half of the tree, there's apples, and the apples are skulls. Okay. And so you see Eve picking the apple skulls and handing them to humanity. And so that's the discovery of death. And that's a catastrophe, right? That's the emergence into self-consciousness. And that is portrayed in our most fundamental narratives as a split in the structure of reality itself. And given the important role that consciousness plays in reality, I think that that's a reasonable statement. Something broke when we became self-conscious. We became aware of our own mortality. And that's when evil entered the world, because you can't be cruel until you understand your own vulnerability. You can't know how to hurt other people until you know that you can be hurt. So when you discover your own limitations, the knowledge of good and evil enters the world. Okay, so there's the tree. And on one half of it are the apple skulls, and Eve is distributing them. And then on the other half, there's a skull at the top of the tree, and the other half, there's a crucifix with Christ in the tree, and then there's other apples, but they're the wheaten hosts that are part of the transformation mass, right? So that's the body and bread of Christ. And so the church, a female, it's the negative and positive female, the church is handing out these hosts to other human beings to invite them to be cured of what how the apple poisoned them. And so there's an idea there, and the idea is, it's a very complicated idea. That's why it's expressed in this painting. And we've been trying to figure out what this idea means for thousands and thousands of years. It's so complicated. It means that if you take on the burden of mortality and you face that completely, that will produce in you a series of transformations that are somewhat akin to deaths and resurrections. And that will elevate your consciousness to the point where you can transcend the catastrophe of self-consciousness. And so that's the meaning of the eating of the body and blood of Christ. That's the idea. It's an unbelievably profound idea that more consciousness is the cure for what half consciousness poisons you with. And that requires this burning off of dead wood and constant retransformation. Then you might say, well, is that only psychological, right? Because you could read it only symbolically. But you might say, well, you don't know, because if people turn around and accept the full catastrophic reality of their existence, and that's this terrible self-consciousness, and decide that they're going to struggle forward admirably despite that, then they actually start to contend with it and fix it. And here's an open question, you know. There's this idea of the genie, and the genie is genius, and the genie is infinite potential constrained in something very tiny. And that's us, you know. We have this terrible constraint, but there's like an infinite potential within us. That's what makes us akin to deity in some sense, and makes us made in the image of God, and is the foundation for our value, our intrinsic value before the law. We treat this very seriously. That potential lies within you. What would happen if you revealed it fully? Well, maybe we would not only dispense with our cowardice in the face of suffering, it's maybe we would overcome, and I don't even know what this means precisely, maybe we would overcome suffering itself. Maybe we would overcome malevolence itself. We don't know what we're capable of. And so that's the answer to that question. It's like, no, you don't shrink backwards. All that does is make things worse. It turns you into an animal, but that doesn't even work because it's too late for that. You can't go back. There's no going back. There's only going forward. And going forward in the full sense means, it means full acceptance of the entire catastrophe of existence and then forthright attempt to do everything you can to rectify it. So...
So I feel like we should roll with this. So what tools should people use to actually do that? I mean, if you were in a clinical practice with somebody and they were coming to you with this, what would you tell them?
Well, if you look at the Sermon on the Mount, for example, the Sermon on the Mount's a very interesting psychological document because it's a meditation on what constitutes that which is of central value. And so it's part of... So what happens in the Old Testament, in some sense, is that human beings watch each other act, and then they conjure up a set of rules that approximately encapsulates civilized action. And so that would be the expanded Decalogue, the law, right? And the law wasn't imposed from the top down. It emerged. It's like Moses, the mythological Moses, let's say, observed the structure of morality and then said, okay, well, here's what it would look like if you made it into rules. You know, it's like a wolf pack watched what it did and said, oh, here's wolf pack rules. You know, and they're not rules to begin with. They're just patterns. Patterns become rules. And then you can follow the rules. But then you have the problem of the rules. It's like, well, the rules conflict with one another. So, like, what's the greatest rule? This is what happens in the New Testament a lot because Christ annoys everyone by pitting one rule against another. So he heals on the Sabbath. It's like, well, is that good or bad? Well, he's trying to point out that you have to produce a hierarchy of rules so that you can produce what constitutes the highest value. And in the Sermon on the Mount, the idea is that it's something like this. It's a bit of an oversimplification, but it will do, is that you want to orient yourself towards the highest good that you can possibly conceive of. And that gives your life purpose, real purpose. And that orientation would be something like the constraint of suffering. But not in just a merely compassionate manner, because that doesn't solve the problem, right? It's a serious problem to address suffering. And the constraint of malevolence, that's partly why Christ meets the devil in the desert, right? You have to transcend evil and you have to face suffering. Those are the part and parcel of developing that ultimate vision. And that vision is something like, well, It's whatever is going to stand for you as the highest value, and that'd be the relationship with God, if you put it religiously. It's to live the best life you can possibly imagine. And that's going to change a bit as you get wiser, but that's what you're aiming at, right? It's like I often tell people, you watch the movie Pinocchio, you know, and Geppetto wishes on a star, and that starts the transformation process of his creation, the wooden-headed puppet who's nothing but a marionette manipulated from behind the scenes. Geppetto raises his eyes above the horizon, looks to that which glitters in the darkness and makes a wish. It's a transformation wish. And that gets the ball rolling. And that's what you need in your own life. You have to decide that there isn't going to be anything that takes the place of you aiming at the highest possible good. Then you concentrate on the day. And that's... And then you stumble forward that way. You know, and rule four is compare yourself to who you were yesterday and not to who someone else is today. It's like, okay, you're not everything you could be. You bloody well know it. And maybe you're too resentful and miserable and bitter and burdened by your self-consciousness to want to do anything about it. But that's not helpful. It's a road, it's the pathway to hell for all intents and purposes. You orient yourself and you stand up straight and face things courageously, and try to find the highest value, because what do you have that's better to do than that? And then you move towards it, and you focus on the day, and you do everything you can during the day to act responsibly and truthfully, and to set things right. And that atones, that brings things together. And that in that manner, you partake in the creation of the world, I would say, in the creation of the world that's good. And that's your ethical responsibility, and in that there might be sufficient meaning to justify the suffering of life. I think that that's accurate. It seems to me to be that works. And, you know, I have people, they come and talk to me all the time. These guys that I talked to this morning, many of them, they say, you know, look, I was miserable and doing a bunch of bad things by their own definition, you know? And they decided they were going to take on some responsibility and bear a heavy burden and try to make things better and to be more honest. And what they report is, well, everything is way better. It's like, yes. Well, then you ask yourself, how much better could we make things? I had this vision once of heaven, you know? It was a very powerful vision. And heaven was a place where everything was, it was like a place where you were eternally playing like a child in a place that a father who loved you had prepared for you. There was that joy in it. But the joy was of a very particular sort because it was a joy that was aimed at producing the next level of joy. So it was like a heaven that would reveal another heaven within it, and then that would reveal another heaven within that. And that there was no limit to that. And maybe that's our destiny to do that. And maybe that's what we're struggling to do now. I mean, we're at a pretty low level heaven at the moment, but it could be much better. And I think that that's what music expresses to us. You know, when I listen to a Bach, say a third Brandenburg concerto, it there's a pattern that emerges. It's beautiful. It's like an architectural motif, you know, like a flower that's opening up. And out of that comes another one, and it's even greater, and out of that comes another one. It's this continual unfolding of crystalline beauty. You see that in your great cathedrals. They're expressions of that in stone and lattice, this beautiful tapestry of structure and light that's a representative of, well, it's a representative of the heavenly city, essentially. It's a representative of what we could be striving to create. And that's what you do with your terrible burden of self-consciousness, you know? And you do that in the day-to-day struggles that you have, and you start small and humbly because that's where you start. There's plenty to fix up around you, you know? And there's no limit to that. And I really believe that. I don't have any idea. This is the problem with 50 years in the future, is God only knows what we could create and what we're destined to create. We're on the cusp of a new age, and if we aimed properly, maybe we could tilt everything so that it would get better and better and better and better and better. You know, what do they say? To those who have, more will be given. And from those who have nothing, everything will be taken. And so maybe we could decide that we would like to be those who have, to whom more would be given. And we start by giving to ourselves, you know, and participating in the process of creative production and the amelioration of suffering and the combat with malevolence within ourselves. And it's the central message of our culture to do that. What are we wrong about that? Look at what we've built because of it. It's no time to give up faith in that. It's time to redouble the faith. As Nietzsche said, there's never been true Christians.